Hey, what's up, everybody? This is Camera Work Podcast number 26. I am your host, John Ricard, and normally sitting across from me would be Ray Tamara, who is a full-time working professional photographer, but sitting across from me is not Ray Tamara, that's someone else. I'll tell you who he is in a second. But Ray is actually out there working. That's the kind of professional photographer Ray is. I'm the kind of professional photographer who on a Sunday night is in an empty studio, in a cold empty studio, doing a podcast. And Ray is the kind of photographer who on a Sunday night is out there working, making some money and creating photographs. But he's in LA for the Grammys right now. I guess he's gonna be shooting like the parties and stuff like that. And he was in Park City, Utah the week before that, which is really cool. And when he comes back, which I'm thinking is like the 30th or something, today is the 26th. When he comes back, we're gonna do an episode, you know, talking about all of this Park City stuff and all of that stuff. I'm dying to hear whatever stories, whatever trouble Ray got into, which is, I'm sure, none.
Yeah, well, he's the adventurous type, you know, Ray. He's always looking to get into a little action.
Yeah, that's Ray, right? But anyway, I'm joined by a friend of mine, Stephen Gomez, who I've known for years. He trains jiu-jitsu with me at Marcelo Garcia Jiu-Jitsu. He's actually higher ranked than me. He's a purple belt. I'm a blue belt, even though I've probably been training three times as long as Stephen, but yep.
You've been training for a long time.
Yes, very long. I'm rocking that blue belt for life. But and he lives in my neighborhood, which is kind of cool. We're kind of similar blood here. And he's also works in the photo industry, which is why we bring him here, not because of the jiu-jitsu or the friendship. But
you mean it's not because I'm so ruggedly good looking?
No, we bring you here because you know something about photography. So okay. What is it you do exactly?
Well, I work for K&M Camera in Tribeca in Manhattan, and I am the head buyer for them.
Right, so what does that mean as a buyer? What does a buyer do for a camera store?
I work with all the vendors, all the different brands, Nikon, Canon, what have you, and I basically put in orders for more product to make sure we're constantly stocked to service our customers, and I go out and look for new brands and new companies that we think we can do very well with and that we think have a future that we can work with and make lots of money.
Right. Now, I'm guessing that's preferable to like being on a sales floor. Like what you're doing is a much cooler job than like...
Yes, I have my own office. And actually, our offices aren't even in Manhattan anymore. We moved our offices to Brooklyn where our warehouse is.
Oh, that's cool. But the store is still on like Broadway or something?
Yeah, the store's on Broadway between Walker and White, just south of Soho.
Right. That's cool. Right. So just one more thing about the store quick. Yeah. How do you describe the store? What kind of camera store is it?
Traditionally, it's a camera store that caters to a traditional darkroom. So film, darkroom supplies, but as that is slowly fading away because we're forever digitizing everything, we also cater to anything you may need digital-wise. We have all the latest SLRs, we have the latest printers you can get. Anything basically you need for photography, we have it or can get it for you.
Right. And it's funny because, you know, I had Sean Cummings on the podcast recently from Smooth Magazine. I'm sorry, he used to be with Smooth. He's now with Show Magazine. So we had him on, and he's used to going to Sammy's Camera in LA. Have you ever been there?
Yep. They're one of our bigger competitors online.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah. But it's a cool store. Like, you go there, it's nice and spread out.
Yeah.
And it's not that busy. Like, they're doing business, but it's not. Like, you're not waiting online to...
It's not B&H.
To talk to someone. Right. That's what I'm getting to. So he goes to B&H, and he's just like, I hate that store.
Mm-hmm.
He goes, I hate the store. He hated everything about B&H. I mean,
I hate everything about B&H. And it's before I was ever involved in working with a photo store. When I was in high school, I hated going there.
Right. Yeah, like he didn't like the fact that, you know, like you got to wait in line, and it's kind of like a Home Depot. And I find that, to some degree, I don't really care about that kind of stuff because, like, I never have a guy. Like, I've been shooting, for example, with B&H. I've been going to B&H since they were on 17th Street. Mm-hmm. My first trip to B&H, I was in college taking a class. And this... I think I graduated in 87 from college. So this would have been about 85 or 86. It's the first time I went to B&H. They were on 17th Street near 6th Avenue. And I've been going there from then till now, and I still don't have a guy at B&H. I don't have a guy in New York City, and I've spent $100,000 on gear in the last 20 years.
Yeah.
But for some reason, that's never that important to me about, like, having a guy.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
My guy, like, ask for John Ricard. If you ask for John Ricard, it's going to mean nothing anywhere, you know? But I do find I kind of resent the fact that they have non-photo stuff there. Like, when I go there, and there's racks of, like, headphones now, and there's, like, you know, what else? Like, like iPod speakers and just...
We're pretty much... I mean, I don't want to say we're copying them, but it's in the photo industry, if you're in a photo retailer... I feel like there's a lot of things that are changing. You can't you can't just survive anymore as just I sell cameras and I sell paper and film.
Right.
Now, I mean, there's so many people, and I think it has to do with the way technology has made being a photographer or videographer so much open to people like normal working people that want to do it as a side job. I mean, if you can offer, like if you have a store and you sell cameras and somebody wants to come in and start making YouTube videos, short YouTube clips, but high quality ones.
Right.
They'll come in, they'll buy a DSLR, they'll need maybe a Tascam recorder, they'll need maybe headphones so they can listen to it. And
yeah, but
you know,
I don't mind that. I don't mind those headphones. I mind the Beats by Dr. Dre headphones.
Well,
and
that's just
25 of
that's
those.
That's just popularity. And I mean, a lot of you also have to understand, a lot of these vendors will give you deals on those headphones if you buy Beats. So like if you want to buy Audio Technica, which we're a big dealer of, and this isn't the case, but as using as an example, if you want to buy Beats, they'll be like, we can sell you the Beats at this price if you buy 100 pieces of this piece.
Right.
So that gives you an incentive. And I mean, Beats are super popular. So I mean, why wouldn't you carry, if you're carrying headphones already, why wouldn't you carry
just
Beats?
Stock those two. Yeah, but it's just for me, it's like if I'm trying to get like seamless paper or 9-inch 20 degree grid, I have to go to B&H. If you're trying to get Beats by Dr. Dre headphones, you've got 3,000 choices to go to.
So I agree.
Sometimes I kind of resent not having my camera store be my camera store. And they're 4 blocks from my studio, so that's the place I tend to go to most.
B&H is like the world's photo store because, I mean, they're just – what the thing I always find funny is you look at two biggest – I look at the two biggest retailers in the world. One of them is Amazon, right? So what I notice is when Amazon – when B&H changes their pricing on photography equipment, if you notice, Amazon will do the same thing.
Oh, that's interesting.
And it says something when Amazon, who's probably the you can get anything on Amazon, has to change their price to reflect
because
the change
of a retail store that is not even a chain. It's just one store.
Just one store.
You know, but speaking of stores, you know, there's other camera stores in the world, and one of them is Unique Photo, which is really cool. They have something called Unique University. They're located in New Jersey, and they do a lot of like seminars and presentations. And I was supposed to do a presentation for them called Principles of Studio Lighting. And this was supposed to be a week ago. And, you know, it's like a paid seminar. People pay. They come to a seminar. I'm going to teach you about lighting. So I go, I load up the car with a ton of stuff because I kind of get crazy with stuff. I mean, I brought like 4 lights, and I've got like soft boxes and beauty dishes and Magnum reflector and just all of this stuff.
You're prepared.
I'm like really trying to teach all of this stuff. I'm trying to cram it into 3 hours. But put it all in the car. It's raining. We're driving with my wife because Ray was away. He was supposed to help me with the thing, but he was doing yoga training. I got to get him to talk about that. Yeah, to like be a yoga teacher. He was doing like a weekend intensive yoga training.
There you go.
But we're driving, and I hit like, I don't know, a patch of water or something, and the car skidded and did like this fishtail thing. Did like a 180, like I'm in the Fast and the Furious, and we hit a guardrail, and then it flipped around again like another 90 degrees or something.
Jeez.
And it ended up off the road. And I'm going to show a picture of it on the screen. And, you know, remember the podcast is on iTunes and YouTube. So whichever one you're listening to, if the other option is easier sometimes, just be aware it's on both. But sometimes on the podcast, I'll put like pictures on the video version. So I'm going to show them the car on this part of the YouTube version of the podcast. But anyway, so the seminar didn't happen last week, but it did happen yesterday. And
how'd that go?
It was amazing. I mean, 35 people were there. Like, it's
the turnout.
Yeah, it's like such an honor to me because like I can get hired by a company to shoot something and make money, and like I'm really glad, and that's really cool. You know, you feel like, wow, someone validates the choice I made to become a photographer. But the idea of like 35 individual people blocking out 3 hours of their day to come hear me talk about lighting and paying a fee because they know this, or they hope that this information is valuable. It's an honor and like a tremendous responsibility that I really take seriously and really, and my goal, I look at it like, I'm sure you're familiar with Creative Live, right? You know, and I actually have texted you a couple of times.
Yeah.
And some
I think
of
we spoke about that the last time I was on the show.
Right, and they do a really nice job and they charge $100. But I looked at it like my goal was I wanted, and I've watched some of their studio presentations and some have been good and some have been just, I want to use the word bad, but that's probably rude. But just some of them have explained things in a way that I think makes it needlessly complicated. Mm-hmm. So my goal was to make sure that for the $50 you were paying for this 3-hour seminar, that I was going to give you as much information as a Creative Live similar seminar was giving you for $100 over the course of 3 days. That was my goal. So I hope I accomplished it. You know, I really tried and I really prepared and got a lot of good feedback from the store, and they mentioned the WPPI show. So I may be at that in Vegas. And if I go out to that, I'm going to you know, talk in their booth there. Awesome. So that should be cool, though. Have you been to that show in the past, WPPI?
I haven't. I've heard of it, but I may be going this year. It seems this is the 2014 is the year of Steven traveling all over the place for extended periods of time.
Right. But that's kind of cool, right? I mean, you're not married, right?
Nope.
So that's kind of cool.
Yeah. No, I mean, I've been to Vegas a ton. And it's an interesting city. That's definitely where you'd want to go if you are, I mean, if you're a company and you want to have a trade show and see stuff. I mean, lots of entertainment, but it will suck your soul out.
Right, right. They give you a decent hotel or whatever? Like, are you doing a hotel yourself? I mean, I guess that's a dumb question. K&M is picking up the hotel.
Yes, they're picking up the tab, thankfully. But they put me in a decent hotel, nothing crazy. I mean, Circus, it was interesting. It's the low roller hotel of the... Las Vegas Strip, but it was good. It was good to me.
Well, it can't be worse than where I stayed in L.A., because one time I went to L.A. really just to train at, like, 10th Planet Jiu-Jitsu.
Yeah.
So I was alone, and I stayed in a hostel.
Oh, man, you're brave. You're brave.
I mean, it's literally, like, $20 for the night, but they got free Wi-Fi, which is funny because the more expensive hotel you're in, the more they charge for the Wi-Fi.
Yeah.
And the crappier hotel, the Wi-Fi is free. But they're free Wi-Fi and free parking.
I mean, in Los Angeles.
Los Angeles, walking distance from that, what used to be called the Grumman's Chinese Theater. I don't know. There's some other name for
it. Is it still
now.
There?
It's there, but it has a different name. I forgot what it's called. But you're right in the heart of everything.
Yeah.
Free parking and everything. And I wish I remember. It's called the Banana Bungalow. If somebody wants to look it up, name.
That sounds like a male strip club.
Yeah, it does. That's funny. But I mean, I'm in a room with literally, 12 other people, in bunk beds and stuff. But, you know, I just wanted to train, so I didn't care. You know, it's only, if I'm traveling with my wife and daughter that I'm more like, okay, we have to get a decent hotel, you know?
Yeah,
but the main show you went to was CES.
Yeah, that was the biggest show I went to.
Right.
And, it was interesting. Over 100,000 people attended this year. And, if you're looking to see the latest technology or, anything involving anything that plugs into a wall or interfaces with something that plugs into a wall, it's going to be at CES.
It's there. Yeah. And was there any, dominant trend? Because, I've been going to the photo show at Javits. I think it's called Photo Plus Expo. Yep. They keep changing the name.
Every year. It's Photo Plus something.
Right. So I've been going to that since, it first started. I don't know if it first started, but whatever, a long time. And I remember Fuji and Kodak would have these huge booths in the front because at the show, the bigger companies have booths closest to the main entrance, and they have large booths. And film was huge, Kodak and Fuji. And every year, those booths would get smaller. And magically, one year, it was bam, it was all digital. It just was not about film anymore. Just the turnover was so quick.
Wow.
It was wow. And Kodak disappeared, essentially. Fuji kept the presence through the printers. And then now, of course, they've got these amazing cameras. But was there any kind of trend that you sort of noticed that seems to be the thing overall at the show?
I mean, talking photo-wise or just in general?
Just in anything.
Oh, anything related to the iPad or the iPhone. The amount of accessories and things people have come up with to interface and work with iPads and iPhones. I'm talking about cases. The amount of vendors there that were from China coming with their the hundreds of different cases for the iPhone or the iPad or flip books and stuff that you can put your iPad into or bags. You can, it's all centered around the iPad.
But it's kind of funny though, because sometimes you get kind of limited that you can essentially only put one case on the phone. Because I have one that takes these iPro lenses, which I love. I used a fisheye lens and when I was shooting for BET, that was paid professional work, and I was shooting the iPhone fisheye all the time because it just looked really cool. It gave it a different look.
Yeah.
But sometimes and now I use this case on the iPhone that has the battery because I love having
the
extra
battery.
Yeah, the Mophie with the extra battery.
But K&M sells those.
Oh, there you go. But usually I don't use a case on the phone because I like it without a case.
Yeah.
But sometimes you see all these accessories and you wish you could have 9 cases for the phone, because once you put one on.
Yeah.
So for me, since I'm using a battery case, I can't use the next guy's case.
Yeah, I hear you. I mean, I'm the same way. I use one case for my iPhone, and it's I think it's called it's called the Poetic. It's a $5 case made in China, and it's literally the best case I've ever used. I've dropped my phone. I'm such a klutz. I dropped my phone down a flight of stairs.
Right.
It was completely okay.
Right. See, usually I like it without the case, though, personally.
I feel like it's too small on my hands, and I have pretty small hands, and I feel like it's just too small.
Right. But I thought it was funny that they had this one on Kickstarter, and it was a case that had this little drawer inside that you could put, your wallet. I'm not your wallet. Your ID and your credit card. I looked at it first. I was like, wow, that's kind of cool. You just take the phone. And I'm like, yeah, but you want to lose your phone? And Now you don't even have a credit card or ID. Like you're
putting all your eggs in one basket.
Yeah, you're literally. You're like in a Matt Damon movie where like you don't exist and you've been wiped out of history because you don't have a phone and
you definitely don't want to be stranded in the middle of Manhattan with no phone, no credit card, and no Metro card.
Right.
Because then you're walking wherever you gotta go.
Right. So in terms of photo stuff at the show, right? Were there any like trends or was there any products that like is the DF like does that get a lot of attention still at something like that? Is that too old already?
No, I mean this year. From what I can tell, this was my first CES, but compared to their other competitors, Nikon actually had a pretty small booth. I mean, they had a little section where they had the cameras and video stuff displayed, and then they had a little platform where there was somebody giving a talk on shooting video with Nikon products, which I think I texted you about when I was there.
Yeah, yeah, you told me the guy. I looked him up. I forgot his name now. But I love those. I can sit. Sometimes I'll go to the photo show and just watch, like the whole day just watching those. Mm-hmm. And it can be a little tricky because sometimes it's so personal, like you look at it and it can bother you because you feel like man, I should be doing that, and you wanna be doing it so bad that it becomes hard to just sit back and appreciate what someone else did because they're doing what you should be doing.
Yeah,
and then I can't watch it, but a lot of times I'm able to just sit and appreciate it, and I love it, you know. But I had this one with Ray where this guy was giving a presentation and he kept trying to make it look like he had gotten photo sessions with people like Brad Pitt and Arnold Schwarzenegger, all these like A-listers, but they were like photo calls. They were like press conferences, these things where he had gotten like 30 seconds with the guy, but he was passing himself off.
I see. That's worse.
And like if you're not in the industry, that might fool you, but if you know what you're looking at, you're like, wait a minute, that's not your session. That's just a photo call, you know? And I just said to Ray, we have to leave. I cannot watch this. My skin was just crying. I just wanted to go up and like call the guy out or something. Yeah. That he's not at the level he's pretending to be.
I hate
on
that.
This thing,
no, yeah, that would bother me a lot too. They had Nikon did have the D3300 there, the new one they announced.
Right.
It's supposed to come in a kit with two lenses, which you don't really see that often.
Yeah.
You
usually, I don't get why they make so many cameras that are essentially all the same.
Yeah. It's all the same with a different model number and a slightly different body, just a little bit.
Right. And I don't get it. And it's funny because, you know, we talked about the DF on the previous podcast. And it was funny to me because
it's your favorite camera, right?
Oh, please. It was the camera I thought could be my favorite, but it wasn't. Essentially, my take on the DF was that what I was waiting for would have been a digital FM2, meaning a camera that was stripped down and had manual controls, but it wouldn't have like 6 flash modes and 7 drive modes and different metering modes, because you really don't need that stuff. It's cool if you have it, but you don't really need it. And, you know, I made an excerpt of that part of the podcast. I put it up on YouTube, and it got a lot of views and got a lot of feedback, and I was really pleased that most of the people who commented on the YouTube link were really intelligent. It wasn't like, go, you're a jackass. It was, you know, intelligent debate.
And,
excuse me. I respond to every comment on YouTube. So if you ever comment on the podcast, please put it on the YouTube page. I read them and I respond to every single comment. But I thought it was interesting when I looked at the reviews of the DF that virtually every review said the same thing that I thought, which I felt, which was that those manual controls were just simply not done right.
Yeah.
You know, and I actually pulled a couple that I just wanted to read really quickly. Like Tom Hogan, who's a big Nikon guy, he's one of my favorite guys on the web, his way of writing about Nikon products, and he wrote, Nikon didn't go all the way with the retro aspect of the DF, and it shows all over the place. This makes for a disjointed shooting experience. And I thought that was such a crazy comment. Like, here are these guys are marketing the camera, like, look at the controls that we put on the camera, and the reviewer is saying, it's disjointed, the controls are bad. Yeah. Like the one thing that they're marketing the camera for, someone is commenting it isn't really done right.
Yeah, I think that's
really funny to me.
I don't know, I mean, when I first saw it, when I first got the press release from Nikon regarding the camera, I thought it was pretty cool just aesthetically. Like looking at it, I was like, oh, that's a pretty cool idea. You're taking the aesthetics of a camera that's, you know, I don't even know how old it is that they're trying to bring back, what, 10 years, 20 years?
It would probably be 20, because even 10 years, we've already been digital. Yeah. We were D1.
Yeah, so 20 years. I forget what year we're in. But, I mean, I have a camera that's very similar to that, the film one that was my dad's. But And I was like, aesthetically, this is pretty cool. I think this would appeal to a lot of people who want that old look, like the Leica, you know. But then I remember speaking to you about it, and you were very unpleased with the way they did the button configuration.
Yeah, because it's like they let it, they're saying if you want to set the shutter speed with the dial on the top, you can, just like you did on an old FM2.
Yeah.
But you can also do it in the menu. Well, it doesn't make sense. Make a commitment to it. And one more that I pulled was Ming Thyme, I guess that's how you pronounce it, who's another blogger that I look at sometimes. And this person wrote about the DF. Said, the control paradigm is confusingly mixed. You need to consciously pause and think for a moment to remember what's done through knobs and levers and what is done through menus. It's insane. Like,
yeah,
you purposely designed the camera with a certain type of controls, and virtually every reviewer has said, great camera, amazing chip. I love the size. I love the files. But I don't like the controls.
Yeah.
It's exact opposite of what they went for. And I think they actually would have gotten better reviews if they had just made a camera like the D800, but with the D4 chip, that would have been fine. That's all they needed to do.
Yeah, I mean, the D800's taken off. D800 and the D800E are probably one of Nikon's best sellers now. The DF, I think, had the ability to be a great camera. They just had to make that commitment to, you know, we're going to go full retro, and the only way you're going to get to set the shutter speed is with the dials, and that's it. And I think they really, you know, I think they really just messed up on that whole thing. But let me see. So let me just tell you a little bit about the CES show a little bit more. Canon, I mean, when I go to these shows, I usually just look at the new product. But this was actually the first time I was at CES, and they were I actually had meetings to attend, which was interesting. I actually got to meet with a bunch of the reps from Canon's Japan's office, their printer team. Didn't really realize how big Canon was. I met one really nice gentleman. I forget his actual name, but he made me refer to him as Sting.
Oh boy.
Yeah, he's like, please call me Sting. I was like, all right.
I'm sure that's short for something.
I think his name was like, honestly, his name was like Satoshi or something.
Right.
And he was like, just call me Sting. I was like, all right, bro, Sting. But yeah, it was really interesting. I had meetings with Canon, I had meetings with Nikon, I had meetings with distributors. It was a very weird mix of come look at all these shiny new things, and by the way, you have to actually do work.
Right. But do you think that they're kind of worried about like what Fuji is doing? Because Fuji...
No.
And if you see, what is the new Fuji that just got announced a few days ago? It has the dials, and they actually did it right. They did what Nikon should have done, where they have dials to control the camera, but there's no other option but the dials. It's like, it hasn't been officially announced, but it's leaked already.
Yeah, I didn't see that CES actually. It's funny because I went through Fuji's booth at CES, and I was actually kind of underwhelmed. They had a really big booth, and the majority of the things that they were pushing was the X100S and their Instax line.
Right.
Which is interesting. And if for any of those who happen to really like the Instax, they're coming out with a X100 looking Instax camera.
Oh, that's cool. My daughter has an Instax, which is it's a little mini Polaroid camera, and I like it. And if you buy on Amazon, you can get like 10 packs of film relatively cheap. Mm-hmm. And then it's like 80 cents a shot. And it's kind of cool. She has like an album of pictures of...
It's a fun little thing.
Taken with the Instax. Yeah, it's kind
of
cool.
A lot of friends of mine use them at parties. They leave little Instax around the house, and people just grab them and take party photos.
Yeah. I've always debated having one in the studio and then take like Polaroids and throw them up on the wall. Mm-hmm. But I'm afraid that once you start with a Polaroid, then everybody wants one. And, you know, again, at like 80 cents or a dollar a shot, you know, you don't want like the artist and her manager and her publicist and her makeup artist. Everybody's like, give me a Polaroid. Yeah. And,
well, we'll talk about that after, because I could probably help you out with that, because we do a lot of Instax. Yeah. But
oh, that's cool. Yeah, we should maybe do that.
Do you know he's a videographer, and I guess he's sort of a photographer, Casey Neistat?
No, I don't think so.
He's actually, his studio is actually a few blocks away from, I think they're two blocks away from K&M store. And he's known for his HBO series he had, in one point he was riding a bike, and it was all about how bikers in New York City get treated unfairly. And you guys can go ahead and look at that online. Just Google Casey and I, it's that on YouTube or whatever. And he's the guy that's riding in the bike lane and tripping over all the debris and just like faceplant. He voluntarily flung himself off his bike in Brooklyn and in Manhattan to show how messed up the laws are in Brooklyn for bike riders.
Yeah, I actually did see that video. They tell him to get off the road, so then he starts showing all the hazards of being on the road. Yeah.
But what I was saying was that in terms of the Instax, was that in his studio, he has an entire wall full of Polaroids and originally it was real Polaroids, but since they're nearly impossible to find now.
And expensive, because they have that impossible project. Which is,
I do not like those.
Because of the price?
The price, you know, it's one thing, because it will sell, especially to hipsters who love the idea of a Polaroid, but the quality is so all over the place. Like, you can get a pack of film from them, and when it comes out exposed, it's all messed up.
Really? I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, I've had a few instances. I used to work at the smaller retail store we had on 21st, right by SVA.
Right.
And I had sold a few to a customer, and he came back and was like, are they supposed to look like this? And they were all over, it was terrible.
Yeah.
You needed to put it through a couple hundred Instagram filters before it looked good.
Right, before it looked like. Yeah,
but he had a whole wall of Instax photos. And I was that's pretty cool for a studio, just every time.
Yeah, I thought about it. Now I may go back to that thought. It's going to be cool to just have these little Polaroids. It's just.
Yeah, just cool moments. During a shoot, just run over, grab the Instax, take a shot, throw it on the wall.
Yeah, because I just don't want everybody give me a Polaroid. And you're I just spent $10 every day on this.
Yeah.
You definitely don't want that.
It's the stick of gum syndrome. The minute you pull out the pack of gum, everybody wants a stick of gum.
Right. But, you know, when you mention Nikon and Canon, I keep wondering, how long they might keep the dominance that they have now. Because when people ask me for camera recommendations, I usually direct them over to Fuji, even though I don't own a Fuji.
Really?
I truly believe the Fuji system is better for most people who are trying to do general portraiture. Mm-hmm. If you're trying to shoot writers in their apartment, or maybe you're in a recording studio with an artist, you know, just this type of general editorial portraiture, mm-hmm. I think you're better off with those cameras, the Fujis, because they're smaller and the quality is fantastic. I think the Nikons and the Canons are ultimately going to be best suited for the kind of work you do for Getty images and wire image, where someone sends you to a red carpet, you're shooting in arrivals, and you need to be able to shoot to 4 or 5 frames a second, or you're doing fashion shows, or you're shooting concerts. I think that kind of work is going to be Nikon and Canon. But for this person who wants to just do casual fashion, you understand, mm-hmm. She has a friend who is a clothing designer,
yeah.
and they're going to go out and shoot 2 models in 10 outfits over the course of 3 hours. This is not intense shooting.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of thing, you're better off on the Fuji.
I could totally see that, but I feel that's one of the reasons why Canon and Nikon are coming out with these cameras that are as powerful as their flagship cameras, but are smaller bodied. You know, because Nikon is Fuji is coming out with these cameras that put out amazing amazing pictures,
right?
And they're small form factor.
Yeah, but the thing with Nikon though is that whenever Nikon has made a small camera, it hasn't been a professional kind of camera. All of their small cameras have always been, you know, like amateur toy cameras. You know what I'm saying? But every time they make a small one, it's like it's an amateur camera. They haven't made a which is what I thought the DF might be, a small camera, but still thoroughly professional camera. And again, image quality it is, but it's just not what we're really, really looking for.
You know what I've always wanted to ask you, since you've been in working photographer for so long?
Right.
What is your experience with camera bags? Do you walk around with a camera in a bag? Do you walk with a camera in your neck?
No, I'm the guy that if you go on YouTube and you search John Ricard rant against camera bags.
Oh boy.
I'm the guy who has, now I think it's only 2 videos, but I had 3 at one time. My take is that the camera bag is useful depending on what you're shooting. What I don't understand is, in other words, say when I shot BET,
mm-hmm.
I had a place I could leave my camera bag. So I'd bring a rolling Think Tank bag, which I like a lot.
And they're a good brand. Rolling, we sell them too. It's a good brand.
Yeah, I have a rolling Tamrac, although the handle breaks a lot. But I like the bag. Still like the bag anyway. But I had a place to leave the bag.
Yeah.
But I'm always shocked that people wear the camera bag while they're shooting, because I never do it. I don't get it. I always like these Domke waist bags. Mm-hmm. They're like little pouches that you put on and you can put your lenses in there. Or I've even traveled with the camera gear in a shopping bag, and I just put the shopping bag in my back pocket while I'm working. If I'm doing something on a street or something, I don't like to wear a camera bag. And I find it amazing that if you go to Disneyland and someone is walking around with a small Nikon with a lens, and then they've got a camera bag, and I'm going, but isn't the bag empty once you take the camera out?
Yep.
So why walk around with this empty camera bag all day?
Especially if you're going to have the camera out all day.
Right. You don't need extra batteries. You don't need a second lens. Unless you're working. If you're just at Disneyland, what do you want to walk around with this bag for? So I can be very anti-camera bag. Very anti-camera bag.
That's interesting. I mean, I ask because there's a very popular clothing brand out of Seattle, Washington, Filson. They've been they've been around for 100 years or so, and all their bags are super high quality, made in the USA, but they're not known for photography. They're known for they're a hunting company, and now they're a fashion company because of the way fashion trends are in New York City.
Right.
People will take something that's meant for, you know, pilots and make it something fashionable.
Right.
But these guys are coming out. They've paired up with Magnum Photo, and they're coming out with a very stylish camera bag that's going to be super functional.
Wait, is that the Magnum, like the photojournalist Magnum? Mm-hmm. Like, wow, that's cool.
And if you're out there or if you're familiar with Filson's bags, then you know exactly what kind of look you're expecting. It's very calm, subdued, something that that looks like that will last for 100 years.
Right. Did they have them there? Like, were you able to see those, or they just showing like pictures and stuff?
This was at the outdoor show in Utah last week, and I was there. And Ray was probably somewhere not too far away.
Oh, that's right. Yeah,
Ray was, because it was the same time as Sundance in Park City, Utah. And they had all the models there. I actually have some photos. I think I have some photos of them. And basically they look like really traditional messenger bags or sportsman's bags. They even have a backpack coming out. And if you look at them from afar, you would never know they're a photo bag. And that's what they wanted to do. But when you open them, they have the little paddings and compartments for lenses and bodies and inserts that come in and out. Yeah, yeah. They're not going
to
be cheap. I can tell you that, because this company is known for making $300-$400 bags.
Right.
But they're definitely going to be a brand that you'll buy once and you'll never really have to buy again. Not because that it broke, but because maybe you got tired of it, but it's a quality brand. Their stuff doesn't come apart, and they have a lifetime warranty. So
that's cool.
If it ever does break, you send it to them, and they'll fix it for you for free.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, I mean,
maybe I'd be looking at something like that, but like I said, I'm very anti-camera bag. Like, if I'm shooting a parade, then I'm not going to be wearing a camera bag. I'm going to have the cameras in a shopping bag, so when I get there, I'm working completely without the bag.
Yeah, it can get cumbersome walking around with a bag and a camera out.
Yeah, but I see people do it all the time. I've put that like on my Twitter. I'll be like tweeting pictures of people going like, why is this guy walking around with a camera bag while he's working?
It always seems a little weird.
Yeah. People do that.
I didn't know you were so anti-camera bag.
Yeah, I've got like actual videos. You just Google like John Ricard rant against camera bags, you'll see. You can look that up.
Funny.
What else do they have at CES photo wise that's cool? Like, are you seeing more stuff with printing?
Like, is that wireless printing? Like little printers? Like, it seems like a lot of companies want to take the size and the idea of like an Instax size photo, printable photo, and just have it like having a little printer like by your door, and you have people over, they can just send pictures to print and stuff. Like, I don't know who would be into that.
No, that sounds cool to me. And I tried to get one years ago for the iPhone, and it didn't work with the iPhone because they're very controlling.
Yeah,
and it was some type of like, it wasn't Bluetooth, it was some other system that it used to connect to the phone. It was a Polaroid instant printer, and it wouldn't work with the iPhone, and it was like frustrating to me. But I think it's a good idea to be able to print some of those Instagram photos and stick them on the fridge and stuff like that, you know.
I don't know, I feel like we've gotten so far away from traditional photography and prints that people forget that, you know, one of the biggest things to do with photos was stick them on your fridge or make a collage in your bedroom. Or frame
and
things.
I haven't printed in years now. I used to maintain photo albums, which looked so cool in the house, and I keep thinking, like, I need to make prints, and I just haven't been.
It's also gotten so expensive now. I mean, paper and ink is ridiculous.
Yeah, I think the smartest thing I ever did, though, was with the home computer, I stopped printing. Like, I used to own the Epson, like everybody, with the tiny little ink that, like, the little blue ink, it costs more than gold. Like, if you think about it, you can go to Saudi Arabia and mine oil from Saudi Arabia and then put it on a tanker and ship it to New York, excuse me, and it's cheaper by the gallon than some blue ink from Epson that's, like, 99% water. Mm-hmm. Why is the ink so expensive? And it comes in these tiny little containers.
Yeah.
Then they're like, you're out of cyan. I'm like, I don't even know what that color looks like.
Ink is probably the biggest, aside from paper, obviously, but ink is probably one of the biggest markets in photography. I mean,
it's the biggest ripoff in photography. Yeah. And an Epson printer will run you $79 because they know you're buying ink for $35.
Oh, yeah, you can get a really good printer super cheap, and you're like, I just got a great deal. Until you have to buy 7 sets of each ink to print that picture you want.
And like, why can't I buy the ink in a gallon? I can get gas.
Costco should carry it.
Yeah, right. You should go to Costco.
Costco and just buy gallons of ink.
Yeah, BJ's another one. Like, they could come back with a big 5-gallon tub of
cyan.
Of cyan
and magenta.
You know?
Buy cyan and magenta, you get yellow for free.
There you go. Right, built in. But so what I did, I bought a laser printer, like a Brother laser printer. It just does the black and white. And you pay like $100 and it lasts like 2-3 years.
Yeah.
You don't have to worry about the ink or anything. And I don't print when I print. I just order.
Yeah.
Adorama, the few
prints
that I might order. So I just eliminated that whole.
I'll tell you, I miss the dark room thing. Though. I did photography in high school, right. All through high school. That's where I learned how to work, how to, you know, shoot, how to print, develop. And I miss the dark room. I mean, it's not financially possible to do that anymore, really. I mean, if you want to do it seriously.
Yeah, every now and then I think about it, like, because I have space in the basement where I could do it. And it looks like fun every now and then, but then when you look at the prices,
you got the enlarger, the paper, the lights.
It's just so much.
I mean, it's not really that good for the environment with all the silver that gets poured down the drain and stuff. It's going to be one of those things where in 10 years, not many people are going to remember what it's like to do that.
And to see a
really good, high quality black and white print or a color print that came from a negative, it's going to be really rare to see that.
Right. Yeah. And then, like, you're always touching those chemicals with your hands, even though you're supposed to wear gloves, but nobody does. You're supposed to use a little tongs, and instead you just grab it with your finger.
Yeah. But it's funny, because when I was in high school, I had broken my wrist playing football, and I was doing photography, and I remember I had the cast on, and the doctor was like, you know, if you're going to be doing this photo stuff, make sure you wrap your arm in a paper and plastic bag, because those chemicals will seep into the cast. Because it's porous.
Be like fermenting and stuff.
So I didn't listen to him, because I'm a teenager, and I knew everything about the world, and I was like, I'll be fine. So 2 months pass, and I'm in, you know, darkroom doing projects, printing, you know, just getting chemicals everywhere. Everyone's so many shirts because of developer and fixer. And the cast comes off, and I have this crazy green ring around my forearm. All the chemicals, like, stored up in the cast. My top of my arm was green for, like, 2 months until it finally disappeared. Right. I don't know where it went. I'll probably get cancer in that arm.
You should have had a picture on your arm. Would have been cool.
Yeah, I
should have. The last photo you shot should have been
the arm, the green arm.
Twilight Zone. But, you know, I had an interesting observation at the beginning of the year, which usually I don't go for that because this is January 26th we're doing this. But every time the new year starts, it's always the stuff on, like, your Twitter or whatever about resolutions
and
10 things to do this year or whatever. So I said, like, I'm going to do one, which I don't usually do. So let me ask you this question. How much self-help, say, books or articles or videos do you watch or read? Or what is one that you like or thought was helpful, or particular author or particular book or something along that line?
It's funny because I'm not really a big fan of these, but my father is. And he made me read Napoleon Hill's How to Win Friends and Relationships.
I'm not familiar with it.
I'm probably completely butchering the title, but it's something called, if you look up Napoleon Hill, it's his most famous book.
Okay.
And it's How to Win Friends and something. And basically, it just tells you how you can be more assertive and more confident, and how this will in turn help your friendships, relationships, and your businesses.
Right.
And I mean, I read it, and I'm not a big fan of these because I think it's a lot of crock. I believe that you can do whatever it is you want to do as long as you believe in yourself. And I feel like that comes from inside. I don't feel like you can read a book and be like, okay, now I'm confident. I feel like you have to go out there and do things and make yourself confident.
Right. And I had this, and the observation that I had, which was a little bit like that, and I tend to read a decent amount of that stuff because it's entertaining, and sometimes it is helpful when you, like, read something that gives you a different perspective on something. Like, you've looked at things a certain way, and, like, you read this book and it makes you look at it differently, or it validates an opinion that you may have had. You know, sometimes I like that. But I came up with this idea. I called it the year of ignorance. I said, I'm going to spend the whole year, and I'm going to not read any books that are, like, self-help. I'm just not going to read them. I'm not going to read any books about, like you said, how to have confidence in negotiating, or just none of those, like, Malcolm Gladwell books about outliers and all of those things.
I read that this year. That was in 2013. I read that. It was a very interesting book.
But I've been thinking, and it's funny because we were supposed to do a podcast where we talked about three books, and I read, like, two of them. I didn't read the third, and I'm still debating whether we're going to do that podcast where we talk about the new Malcolm Gladwell book that
David and Goliath,
right? And then we were supposed to talk about this book called Decisive by Dan and Chip Heath. And the third one was Scott Adams, which was the title was something like How to Fail at Almost Everything and Still Succeed, or something along that line. So we were supposed to talk about those three books, and I'm still debating whether I want to do it because I had one I still didn't read. And I just thought, like, kind of like you said, like, well, maybe you don't need to get the information from a book. Maybe just apply what you know and live the year of ignorance.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because the people who are writing this book clearly have figured something out because they've managed to publish a book successfully and become known for it. Like Malcolm Gladwell published Outliers, and
right.
he's known for it. And David and Goliath has had a really good reception. I actually have it at home. I haven't read it yet, though, but I have it.
Right.
And I feel like there is something you can take away from them, but I feel like for everybody's different and everybody has different personalities. Some people are shy. Some people are outgoing. And I feel like if you're going to do something for business, right. you know, it takes a certain type of personality. And to an extent, you can learn how to kind of fake your way through it. If
right.
it's not yours, you'll learn it. But right. you're really gonna achieve that kind of personality or skill by doing. You can read a yeah. thousand books, but you'll never know until you gain the experience.
Yeah, that's the thing, is the doing is so much more of it. You're
yes.
better off giving 100% to the doing and frankly doing it badly than being super knowledgeable
yeah.
and not having the right motivation.
Yeah. I mean, anything you try new, you're going to fail at, and you'll only
right.
know how to do it right once you've done it a few times.
Right.
Nobody ever gets anything right the first time.
Right. Well, that was the Scott Adams book. See, now I'm starting to talk about it, and I shouldn't do this. Then we may not do that episode, so I can mention it now. But
quick blurb.
But part of his philosophy was just that he was trying to say don't set goals, because he was trying to say if you set a goal, you're almost in a constant state of failure.
Mm-hmm.
So if, let's say my goal were to, whatever, shoot the next Nicki Minaj album cover, and then instead of doing that, I'm photographing the Nicki Minaj album release party, and a record label gave me $750 to shoot this.
Yeah.
Okay, I could walk into that room and feel successful because I'm making $750 and I'm shooting a party. It's a couple hours work. It's fun. It's fine. I'm making money. But if I'm focused on my goal that I wanted to shoot her album cover, then I might feel like a failure.
Yeah. Almost like you're in arm's reach, but you're not quite there.
Right, because I didn't get the real goal that I wanted, which was to shoot the album
yeah.
cover and not to be shooting the party. So his way of thinking was like, don't set a goal. Just have like a system for trying to move forward, but don't be focused on a goal. Whereas you read 20 other books, they're going to say have goals and
yeah.
write them down and look at them every day and recite them and
yeah.
tell your friends. And sometimes I think you get too much clutter also from reading some of the self-help stuff
yeah.
or watching these videos that are supposed to help you.
A lot of them I feel contradict each other too in terms of how to approach certain situations. I don't think I'm a big goal guy. I mean, I have goals and I write them down.
Right.
I think that's important because I feel like once you put them down on paper, you make it a reality.
Right.
But I mean, it's hard for me when I look at, you know, what goals I have. Pretty much it's just to further my career, get better at jiu-jitsu, and
right.
you know, maybe one day get married, maybe.
Right.
That, like, those are my main goals, and being
right.
happy.
You listed them in order of importance.
Yeah.
That's good.
I mean, like, my main goal in life is
right.
just be happy
right.
and to do things. Like, if I'm doing something and I'm not happy with it or it's making
right.
me unhappy, to just rid myself of it.
Right.
And my big goal for 2014 is to just take more risks and just be more assertive. Because,
right.
I mean, I'm pretty confident, I think, with what I do in life and in general.
Right.
And I feel like if I'm just a little bit more assertive, I'll be
yeah.
much more successful.
Yeah, I think overall, when it comes to regret, most of the time the regrets are what you didn't do,
mm-hmm.
not what you did. And when you look at movies, like whenever there's a movie about a guy and like a girl, and it deals with like they met in high school, the story is always the same. It's always he regretted that he
yep.
didn't get with the girl.
He wasn't aggressive enough.
Right, or he didn't form that rock band or whatever.
Yep.
I think that's the thing. And so many of us, I think, we feel like we need permission to do things, or we feel we can't do it, or we can't see ourselves a certain way. And I think it's one of the good things about when we train martial arts is, like, if you left it up to you, and you tell me if I'm wrong, but if we left it up to you, you might never be a purple belt, because you would never look in the mirror and go, I'm now a purple belt. Like, imagine if a martial arts school said, put on whatever belt you want to put on. When
yeah.
you're ready for purple, walk in with a purple belt. You might never put that on.
It's true.
But you need someone to kind of push you sometimes and go, you are a purple belt, and then you rise to that level.
Yeah,
but
no.
if you could inwardly be more assertive, then maybe you could sort of say, or more confident, or whatever those words are that we all struggle with, you could be walking around going, I am now a purple belt
yeah.
in my photography or in my dating or in my work or whatever, and move to that next level. But I think we put ourselves in these boxes so many times.
Yeah,
it's a shame.
It happens
know?
A lot. You corner yourself into something, or you're made to believe something a certain way about something.
Right.
And it's really up to you. I really believe if you're like in a funk, or you're not
yeah.
feeling good about where you're at,
yeah.
it's up to you to go out there and try something new. I mean, Right. You never know what you can do until you try. And if you fail, right. it's better to fail at something that you've never done than to never do it and wonder if you could have.
Right. And I think, too, if you have good friends helps, because if you have those friends that are kind of shooting you down or trying to get you back in that box where they yeah. know you, it's bad. But if yep. you have the kind of friends that you might be like, man, you know, I wish I could like direct a music video, and that friend's going to go, well, I got a guy. I got this other friend who wants to rap. Why don't you let me hook you guys up? Then you're in the right circle. But
yes.
sometimes you find yourself around those people that are like, well, why are you going to do that?
Yeah.
And it's not a good place to be in, yeah. you know.
Well, like most people say, most of the time you find success outside your comfort zone. So
of
you
course,
have to go outside
yeah.
of where you're, you know, what you normally do and explore it, see what happens. There's,
right.
there's nothing wrong with trying something new.
Yeah, and I got this move. I'm not going to talk about it on a podcast yet. If I make the move, I'll talk about it. But I've been debating, like, kind of shifting what I shoot, kind of away from the music / celebrity type of photography that I do into a really different genre. And, like, sometimes I wonder, well, what makes me not sure if I'm going to do it? Like, what am I? Am I afraid of something? What's the...
It's probably because you, I mean, you know, we spoke a little bit about it on the way over here. I
right.
mean, it's just a new frontier. You've built,
yeah.
you stayed in your type of photography for so long. You're comfortable there,
yeah.
and you know what you're doing.
Yeah.
You know, it's always going to be scary going. Like if I handed yeah. you a big old lens, I was like, okay, I need you to become a professional bird photographer. I want you to capture the most beautiful pictures of New York City pigeons you can find.
Yeah.
Like, it's a completely different realm.
Yeah, that would suck.
Yeah, I mean, it's like somebody like, okay, now you work at Macy's. Go buy all the latest fashion. I would not know what to do.
Right. We're in our little zone.
You know,
but,
yeah.
but hopefully people will, you know, find their little spots out of it, you know, if possible,
yeah.
hopefully, you know.
Yeah. It's interesting. I know for myself, I'm a big gear dude. I like having toys and, you know, different kinds of things I can play with. And I'm not a professional photographer. So as a professional photographer like you are, what would you say is one or two pieces of gear you don't think you could ever be without, aside from a camera, as you would need that.
Oh, that's tough. Wow, I was thinking camera-wise. I, like, would not be without. Wow. That's really tough. I'm not sure if I'm answering this question right, but I know I still like the iPod Classic.
Mm-hmm.
I really like that. I like the idea of having what I guess you would call a dumb device, because, you know, I'm on the Apple system, so I've got the
yeah.
iPad and a bunch of iPhones and old iPhones and all this stuff, and they're intelligent, and they do these crazy things, like you're listening to a podcast and then you sync the phone and then the podcast disappears from the phone, or you just get these crazy things like
yeah.
with Apple sometimes because it's trying to be automatic. But then I have the old school iPod where if I want to play a song, I don't have to look for a Wi-Fi connection. I don't have to
yeah.
wait for the thing to load.
Mm-hmm.
And the computer never just erases a song for me randomly. So I don't know how much that qualifies as a gadget, but I think
yeah, totally.
The old school gadget, the idea that I've got like 10,000 songs in my pocket and it's always loaded with like a ton of jiu-jitsu videos
mm-hmm.
and it's loaded with like movies I haven't watched yet and old rock music that I liked in the 80s and then modern hip hop that I can listen to now. And I love having the old school iPod Classic. And I just wish, if Apple's listening, because, you know, I'm sure Steve Jobs is in heaven listening to this podcast and sending messages to Apple. Excuse me. The one thing that they should do, they should make the iPod Classic be able to hold HD video. Because what happens is you don't want to watch it in HD on a screen, but if you have a movie file on your computer that is in HD, let's say it's at 1080p or whatever,
mm-hmm.
you can't put it on the iPod Classic. Like, I don't want to watch it in HD. I just want to put it there so
yeah.
I can watch it in whatever quality. But
yeah.
you physically can't put it onto the iPod. And that can be very frustrating, especially if you want to use the iPod as a device to show that movie on a TV in HD. It'd be nice if it could just carry the file and transfer it. But you run into those limitations with it, and that becomes very frustrating.
Yeah. No, I found that interesting because a lot of people always, everybody has, like, their little hobby and their niche, and I have a lot of friends who are into the same things I am, like, gear-wise and whatever. And, you know, jiu-jitsu, you can never have enough gis. Well, maybe not you, but because you don't like the gi.
Did 3 years without a gi.
Yeah, but, I mean, like, we know people who have tons and tons of gis, and that's their thing. They just keep buying gis.
Right.
It's their gadget.
Yeah, and then in jiu-jitsu, there's a thing called the show your old gi. I don't
yeah.
get it.
Oh, I have,
do you have one of those?
I have a few of those, yeah.
Yeah, and there's, like, a line, because I was at this tournament, I guess
yeah.
they call it the Worlds in
yeah,
L.A.
Yeah.
or whatever,
mm-hmm.
it was Long Beach. And then there was a line. I'm like, well, what's the line for? I figured it was like some guy signing autographs. They're like, no, show your role is selling the gi.
Well, the problem, the thing with that is, I mean, I know the owner of Show Your Role. He's a friend of Paul's, and he's a really nice guy, Bear. He's done with his brand of Show Your Role, of his gi company, is what Nike's done with Jordan. They make them in limited quantity. So it's added like this cool factor, this collector factor. And their guys on Instagram, if you search for the hashtag Show Your Role or Show Your Role Collection, I forget which one, you'll get pictures of people's closets literally with 10 plus gis, all Show Your gis, never worn.
Oh, and they're so just going to be selling them like sneakers?
Because they do sell on eBay for more than what you bought them for. Like I remember I had one. It was the New York City themed one, the Yank. It was navy. It was Yankee themed. It was navy, and all the accents were like in gray.
Right.
And I bought it. It was like $180 gi. So it's a pricey gi. I sold it online for like $320.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So I made my money back plus some.
I got to get into that business.
Yeah, it's good. And they have now a whole, I mean, I don't want to give them like a whole ad, but they have like a whole service now. It's called Guma, and they sell it every year at Thanksgiving, and it's a membership. So you pay like $200, and you're given early access and special access to certain gis that they won't release to the public.
But they don't get the gi, you just get the ability to buy the gi?
When you sign up, you get like a package deal. So you get like a backpack and like a gi for signing up.
Oh, okay, for the $200.
Yeah, and then you have the ability to see gis. Because you know, when these gis come out online, like the websites get all choked
they
up.
They go instantly, like the sneakers.
So so you get early access to buy all these new gis and all these exclusive Guma only gis. And then what these guys do is they buy it, and they've mathematically figured out, these guys who buy them, that it's worth spending the $200 and then buying these gis early.
Right.
And then flipping them on eBay and getting your money back, because you'll end up with, at the end of the whole thing, I think you end up with like you're in the green zone of like $300 or $400 selling them, and you can buy all anything else you need. Yeah,
it's like the first time you see those kids online outside the Foot Locker to buy sneakers, then you just go like, get a job, you know, jackasses out here waiting for sneakers. And then eventually you learn like, oh, okay, a lot of them are selling the sneakers on eBay, and they're selling them for tremendous amounts of money. The limited edition sneakers, and you're like, oh, they actually do have a job. This is their job.
Kanye West has his pair of sneakers from Nike, I think. It's Yeezys. And those things are like thousands of dollars. Like, it's impossible to find a pair for less than a grand.
Yeah.
And I mean, Jordans, I mean, when I was in high school, I had tons of Jordans. I still have tons of pairs of Jordans in my closet that are probably worth $200-$300.
Yeah.
I'm never going to sell them, I'm sure.
Yeah. We've had Mitch Jackson, my friend who's the writer, he wrote the book, The Residue Years. And he's like that. When I go to his house, he's got these like plastic shoe boxes, and it's like a wall of sneakers. And it's amazing to me, because generally I own one pair of sneakers and that's it. Just one at any given time, because I just don't care.
Mean, I'm not a big sneakerhead anymore. I mean, I have a pair of Converse, and I have a pair of boots, and I have a pair of Vans, and I wear according to the weather. So if it's raining or snowy, I'm wearing boots. If it's sunny and hot, I'm wearing the Vans.
Right. But you mentioned about gadgets. Do you think that there's a must-have gadget right now that's kind of crucial for people to have, or like one coming that's going to really make waves again? Did you see anything at CES that you thought like, this is going to be like the iPad, where it's sort of like a game changer and everybody's going to have one? And we were wondering, well, how did we live without an iPad 5 years ago?
You know, I didn't see anything like that at CES. I think the iPad is that thing right now.
Right.
Especially with the way they're making it so small and light, and you know,
it's the new one's really cool.
It's
the Air
super
is
tiny.
Nice.
Yeah. But the thing that I saw people were just eating up was the GoPros. Everybody and their mother has a GoPro.
Right.
And I don't know why, because I see people writing. I mean, I get it, and I think it's super cool if you're gonna do something, you know, exotic, like jump out of a plane or something.
Right.
But
that's the weird
thing. Seeing bike messengers ride up and down through Manhattan traffic. Yeah, it's cool the first time. But eventually somebody's going to catch themselves being hit by a truck on it, and it's not going to be that cool.
I didn't think of that.
Yeah.
But the thing about the GoPro is, like a lot of products, the GoPro is fantastic for what it was made for. Meaning if you're going to jump off a mountain, there's really nothing better than a GoPro.
Yeah. Or go surfing.
Yeah, surfing. It's small. It's light. The case is waterproof. It's perfect. But you see people using GoPros for all these things. Like, for one thing, once you put the GoPro in a case, it virtually has no sound.
Yeah.
And we filmed this podcast on something called the Sony Music Video Recorder, which is an absolutely horrible name for a product. And you know, I guess you can Google it to see what it looks like. But this particular recorder gives you video quality very similar to a GoPro. And you can see if you're watching this on YouTube, it's very wide like a GoPro. Now, you lose a couple of things. You lose the ability to like change your white balance and to adjust your exposure, which is very easy to do on a GoPro using the iPhone app or, you know, the Droid app, whatever. But the audio quality is really good on this. And like, I'm going to switch to that audio right now. And I wouldn't be surprised if it sounds better than the actual podcast audio, because the audio is really good, and sometimes we get issues with the complicated audio equipment I have. So for anybody just listening, okay, right now we're switching to the audio from the Sony music video recorder, and like I said, I wouldn't be surprised if it sounds better than the real gear, you know, because the audio was good. So I recommend that over the GoPro for a lot of different uses that you're doing, because you're going to get essentially the same video quality. But if people are talking, you can hear them. Whereas the GoPro, you put it in that waterproof housing, you can't hear what anybody's saying.
Yeah, no, I mean, people have taken the GoPro, what was essentially meant for extreme sports and stuff, to give you that point of view look, and they're using it because the quality, the video quality is amazing on it. For something so small, it's great. Right. And they've adapted it to do different things. Like, they'll use it to set up multi-shot scenes. I've seen people, people who are like gun enthusiasts are using it when they go to the range. They're setting it up right by the muzzle of the gun, so that when they shoot, I mean, you normally wouldn't want to put a super expensive camera near that close to a firing gun, or stand near that to see that.
Right.
So it's given perspective, different really cool perspectives of shots.
I think it's funny, and I'm going to switch back to the audio, the so-called real audio, which I pray sounds better than the Sony music video recorder audio, because I mean, we spent probably like $1,000 on the audio for this podcast.
Gotta use it.
But sometimes the audio isn't even right, and we spent a lot of money on it. But I noticed you can see on TV a lot, you start the look of the GoPro, and then the character start like driving a car, and then like you're like, oh, they shot that with the GoPro.
Yep.
It's no longer that film quality that they had a few seconds ago.
Yeah, you can tell.
It's super popular.
It's a good look. I think it's almost like a relaxed, I call it fisheye sometimes.
Yeah.
And it's not super intense, but you can tell it kind of has that look where it's like, it's a GoPro.
But you know, there's something really cool coming out. You know, there's something that they call an anamorphic lens. It's kind of like a wide angle lens, but it doesn't have that type of barrel distortion like you're saying. And it's 16:9 ratio,
the image
that would produce, or a little wider. And someone's making a Kickstarter for the iPhone of that anamorphic lens. It'll work on the iPhone 5, and I'm still on the 4S, and I think...
Gotta upgrade, man.
When that lens comes out, I think I'm gonna upgrade to that, because it looks like a lot of fun to have this really cool wide-angle lens, and they said they kind of made it on purpose, like the Zeiss lenses that they shot Star Trek on, where it flares a lot from the light, and it looks really cool to get like, you know, these like moving...
Yeah.
I don't know what you can call them, lens flares or something. Mm-hmm. So I might get that. It looks really cool. Maybe we'll even film some of the podcast that. I don't know.
Speaking of iPhone clips, have you ever played with the Olo clip? It's very similar to the thing you were telling me about before.
Yeah, I used the iPro. There was no reason why I picked one or the other, but for whatever reason, I ended up on the iPro, and I like it a lot. But I've never used that
Olo clip
one. I know it's popular, though.
I can't get behind the whole adding lenses to iPhone things. I don't know what it is. I can't have this giant thing hanging off my phone as I shoot something.
For me, I think it was getting the fisheye without carrying a giant fisheye. That's really the only one I use, is the fisheye.
Okay, that makes sense then.
Yeah.
Carrying a whole separate lens for that would be kind of annoying.
And for a while, we were shooting the podcast on the iPhone, but on my phone, I think because I put so many like movies on it and everything, it would always crash and it would die, and then we wouldn't get the whole podcast. So if you watch it on YouTube, it's like the first 40 minutes of that video, and then the video would drop out because the battery died on the phone or whatever. But then we would use the wide angle or the fisheye on it, though, you know.
Yeah.
But all right, but I think we're going to wrap there. Any other point we might want to mention?
No, I mean, I think we got everything. We had a pretty good discussion.
Yep, very, very cool. All right, then. So we're going to be back, I don't know, like in a week or 2 weeks, whatever, whenever Ray decides to show up again, and I'm going to have him talk to us a little bit about what it was like to shoot at Park City and to do the Grammys and all of that while I was sitting in a cold studio. All right. If you want to find me, the best place is Instagram. I'm on Twitter, but my Twitter pretty much just repeats my Instagram. And I find it so frustrating trying to fit my thoughts into 140 characters that I get so frustrated with Twitter. Everything I want to say, I have to go back and start chopping words.
Yep.
And I have to start writing like Prince. And every time I want to write T-O, I have to put the number 2. And, you know,
that's
I have
funny.
To spell everything with Z's like I'm Prince, because I can't fit anything in 140 characters. So find me on Instagram instead. It's John Ricard, JohnRicard. Steven, where do we find you?
You can find me on Instagram. I mostly just post pictures of food and just random things, usually food and alcohol.
You
can find me at CMDRSTEPHEN.
Right, that's the Instagram.
Yeah, that's
correct.
Instagram. And,
right.
Yeah, and if you're interested, I mean, if you're interested in gear or whatever, photography, you can look at, you can check us out at www.kmcamera.com, and we're in Tribeca. So come on down.
And we can catch you on the mats at Marcelo Garcia Jiu-Jitsu.
That's right. If you wanna do some rolling around, come check out Jiu-Jitsu.
Yeah, it's the best, right?
Yep, it's the best way.
All right, thanks, guys. We will see you next time. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Perfect. All right, that was